Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We for UNITY. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now the time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now.
This is Jamal Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. I'm here at Black Radio Hall of Fame at the historically black Harris Stowe State University. So we have a lot to unpack and talk about today. And we want to really start with introducing our guest for today. So Michael Samanga is originally hails from Detroit, Motor City, but he's been in Atlanta for some time. He is a organizer, activist, poet, writer, scholar, freedom fighter. He is now at Morehouse College, you know, shaping these next generation of young minds and mentoring them. He's also former publisher of the Third World Press. But one thing that is really impressive about him is that he's a multidiscipline artist who has written, produced, and directed more than 200 artistic projects, including music, film, theater, and festivals. So welcome to the show, Michael Samanga.
Well, thank you so much, and for that lovely introduction. It made me think about who is she talking about, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. So one of the things organized under the delusion of democracy, and most people who've kept up with my writing or my talking will know that rarely do I refer to the U.S. as a democracy. I might have an adjective. This is a so-called democracy or a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So because, or I might say this experiment called democracy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we really do need to define democracy, because as we talk about some of these other ocracies, like, you know, oligarchies and authoritarianism and all of that, that we need to be clear where we stand and where we stand as particularly as we're critical of other countries in this country, then we know what that's all about. So what is your definition of democracy?
Well, like you, it ain't this. But it has never been. You know, America's so-called democracy is the best in the world at disguising itself. Because America is very much like any other wealthy imperialistic nation. So, from the beginning, it was constructed by a group of mostly wealthy white men. And their idea was really a disguise for maintaining and building the power of a certain class. You know, these people were big landowners. Some of them had black people in slavery. The ones who were not wealthy, but they were part of their intellectual class. And they were willing to sacrifice, you know, all kinds of people of color to build this empire of whiteness, including the role of the white Christian church that for the most part supported the theory, and actually made it beyond theory. They made it theology that black people were inferior by God and therefore was all right to enslave them and to work them to death and to torture them and rape them and, you know, abuse them. And you see the rise of that again today, where people are openly saying America was founded as a white Christian church. I mean, white Christian, country, and that the evangelical church is determined to restore America to its, you know, white Christianity. But the main thing about democracy is that it's supposed to be the rule of the people, and that the government is just an instrument of the people's will. That's never been the case in the United States. In fact, the very first indication of this anti-democracy is the construction of what's called the Electoral College. America's almost 200 million people voted in the last election. And less than 600 people have the right and the authority and the power to determine who won that election. That's not democracy.
That's not democracy, but here's where history is so important, Michael. There are still people in 2023 who don't know or understand the Electoral College. You know, periodically I will write about it and folks will say, well, where's that college located? I mean, it's
right,
like,
right.
Come on, people. We've been in this country for a while. These folks that we are talking about, we've studied them just like they've studied us. So why aren't we responding in a way that is more rooted in the historical reality? Because I thought we were going to talk about Reconstruction, which I think was one of the first like slaps upside the head about democracy. And last year I had Penny O. Joseph come and talk about the third Reconstruction. So when we talk about democracy, you're right. We really haven't seen it. There's been attempts, and maybe they were noble attempts. But whenever we start to assert ourselves and our rights, the white lash is vicious.
Oh yeah, and you're right about Reconstruction, and that's where I was going, because it's never been a democracy, especially for us, especially for Native people and Spanish, Hispanic descendants and all of that. There's never been any kind of true democracy, and not for working class white people, and especially not for poor people of all colors and communities. But this idea that you construct a government and the propaganda is that this is for the people, by the people, of the people, that everybody has an equal vote, that we are the representatives of the will of the people. It's not true. It has always been skewed to make sure that the same class of people remain in power, and those people who are in political positions maintain the power of that rich class. In America, just like in some other countries like South Africa and places like that, the wealthy class is predominantly white. The powerful class is white, even though there might be some people of color in it. There are no black people who are comparable to, say, the Koch brothers.
Right.
We don't even know where their money is going, when it's going. They don't even say anything publicly, but I tell you, folks are in politics want them on their side because they want all that money and influence. And so, just like the beginning of this country, the same standards go. Rich people determine what the politics and policy are going to be. And the illusion of democracy is that the average citizen gets to vote, but their vote doesn't always mean what they think it's going to mean. It doesn't bestow the power upon the average citizen that it should. And, you know, if it's going to be a true democracy, the will of the people. And all you have to do is listen to Congress one day, and you will realize that they are not talking about anything that's going to benefit the people. And if they do, it's going to be compromised to such a degree. We still have people right now who are trying to overturn the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Who are openly saying we can't be a country that has, you know, free health care.
Socialized medicine.
Right, right. And, you know, it's, people will fall for that because of the term socialism, you know. But what they're really falling for is capitalism.
Mm.
They are really falling for pharmaceutical companies and hospitals and wealthy people who own hospitals saying, we don't want universal health care because then we lose money.
Right.
We can't charge what we want. And this is true across the board. The educational levels are much greater in terms of what they learn, the skills they acquire, in rich, affluent neighborhoods than they are in the average middle class or working class, and certainly in our under-resourced communities. And that's by design. The ability of one party to create a gerrymandered state to deny the full voting rights to another group of people, that is a part of American politics. That should be illegal, and it was
for a long time.
The Voting Rights Act, yeah. Under the Voting Rights Act, they had to go and get authority to any kind of shenanigans like that. And now that they have a Supreme Court who says, yeah, no, that, we don't need that anymore. Things are fine. You know, democracy prevails. But the reality is that the party of Trump, some people call it the Republican Party, but the party of Trump played a long game in American politics, slowly but surely attacking those things that had been kind of won in the civil rights movement and the civil rights era and the Black Power era. And they have been consistent at it since the 1960s. They have challenged the Voting Rights Act almost every year or every election year until finally they had enough control of the Supreme Court and some of the lower courts to push it up to the Supreme Court for them to say, you know, we're not going to do this anymore.
Right. There's no need for it.
Yeah, right, right. We finally accomplished. There's no racism here. Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. And the same thing they're doing with admission to colleges, the return of Jim Crow at its height in housing again. Mm. I mean, over and over again. And the creation of wealth-generating enterprises that are inherently oppressive. As an example, these private prisons. I saw a study a couple years ago that these private prison entrepreneurs determine where they're going to build a prison based on third grade reading scores.
Right, right.
So they look at children who are struggling to read as a way to make profit as opposed to teaching them how to read. Because their assumption is that they, you know, are not good students, they don't have access to certain books and education and stuff, more than likely a higher percentage of them is going to prison. So we need to be ready for that population.
And so with that, Michael, let me interrupt you, because what we've seen is a different prison population. And this is, I've heard this even from brothers and sisters within. So maybe 20, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, the folks who could read actually were reading in prison. They were developing themselves so that when they came out, if they should come out, they were going to be an asset to our community. And so what we see now are people whose reading levels are low, and so they stick a TV in front of them, and what they do is watch TV all day. So any mention of, you know, going to have a discussion about this book or that book, is not a cool thing. And so just really trying to get folks to protest the conditions inside, you know, it's almost like what it is out here, because there's this layer of apathy that has been put on people, like, you know, really can't do nothing about it, so might as well, you know, chill or whatever. But I do want to go back to this notion about what voting means, and because you mentioned that people are not voting because of how they feel. And this has been, I think, a very delicate dance that organizers have had when we talk about, you know, mass-based building of power. Mm-hmm. And voting is not the only way, but it actually quantifies numbers. And so if you got somebody that you got them to vote for a particular bill, or whether it be local or federal, that said something. But what you said makes it seem like, okay, you voted for it, but, you know, so what? It's not going to be implemented. It may not be funded. And in fact, we may overturn it, much like what they did Roe v. Wade. So how do organizers continue to press for support and protection of voting rights if, in fact, it looks like to the average, you know, Jabari or Johari that nothing is really going to change?
Yes, and I think that that is a very pervasive kind of thinking. And part of it is just the frustration that people feel when they work for something so hard and then it gets, you know, dismantled or discarded or just not paid attention to. So it's a couple things. I think that we have to, in our messaging as organizers and ministers or politicians, whatever it is, progressive politicians, we have to talk about freedom is a long struggle. And this has been a long road. I have students who sometimes say nothing has changed. You know, we're talking about, you know, black people's lives and stuff. And one of the ways I respond to that is, did you come here on the back of a bus? And then they stop and they say, no, I drove up in a new car that my mom and daddy gave me, you know.
Well.
So, you know, when you break it down to the accomplishments that our people have made, and this is the other thing, you know, we have never been conquered. This is, our struggle here has been every generation. You know, I love the mantra that was inherent in black life during the enslavement. It's not me, my children. And it's not my children, their children. And it's not their children, their children, but one day we will be free. And to keep that vision for 250 years in the worst possible conditions a human being could be in, that says something. And so when we get to contemporary times and people who actually have benefited from that, they weren't a part of it because they were not born or young. They feel like, you know, they're shooting us down in the street too, and I got a college degree. They're shooting us down and I, you know, work in a tech company, and their understanding of the ebb and flow of war, because that's what it is. It's a political, social, cultural war, and also in some cases it's a military war. The attacks on black people by the police, that is a military operation. That's people sitting around saying what they're going to do, drawing up a plan and then doing it.
Absolutely.
And we don't have a broad enough or deep enough response. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is because this is a different time. You know, Jamala, you and I grew up in the Black Power movement. You know, we came into adulthood through civil rights and black power. And so the movement was in full bloom and picking up steam. But it was also being subjected to tremendous violence and, you know, assassinations of leaders and disruptions. By the government.
Right.
By the so-called democratic government.
Right.
That was suppressing people's constitutional right to free speech and right to assembly. All of the things that are in that constitution, these government agencies had been ordered to disrupt those things, including committing murder if it, you know, took that. So I think we want the idea of democracy to work, but we're in this quagmire of the history of the United States. It's always got like a head fake. Okay, everybody can vote now, but
yeah.
If you vote in Atlanta and you have to stand out in the hot sun in July to vote, and somebody comes to give you some water, they will be arrested for a felony of interfering with, you know, a voting process.
Right.
So, yeah, you can go do it, but
here are the consequences for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Expressing your rights as a citizen.
Right.
One of the things that's interesting historically is the Nazi Party studied Jim Crow as a way to figure out how to deal with a segregated society. And in their case, they were segregating Jews, people who were gay, people of color, or people who were from nations that they felt were beneath the Germans, you know, particularly some of the Slavic nations. And they determined that, America got a good thing of segregation, but it's different because they have, black people have been enslaved for a while. So that makes sense. It was easy to do that. but, and it's so many of them, and they're poor. So their thing, their analysis was most of the Jews were not poor, and that they had, you know, college degrees and things like that. So they were more of a problem. We're not doing just a segregation thing. We have to eliminate them. So they both pass segregation laws and they pass laws that they can round these people up and commit these heinous crime against them and humanity. In the United States, we have to remember that fascism existed here for 100 years, but it was only applied to us. See, that's the deepness of it, that black people literally lived under fascist governments. They weren't elected by majorities because we couldn't vote. They weren't following the Constitution because it was not extended to us, not the federal Constitution or the state constitutions, except those provisions in the state constitutions of the South that said it was okay to do what they were doing to us. We were forced to remain in poverty through both, you know, the politicking, but more effectively from the violence or threat of violence. I just saw something recently that said in the South during the Jim Crow, era, a black person was lynched every 4 days. And I was at the doctor a couple of days ago, and the sister who's the nurse was an elder, and she was telling me about growing up in South Georgia. She said, I remember lynching. In my town, they used to hang black people and let them stay there all night and wouldn't take them down until midday the next day because they wanted all the black people to be reminded.
And so this is somebody that's got a modern day memory of this. So it's not in the distant future. If you are just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host for Voices from the Battlefield, and we're talking today about organizing under the illusion of democracy and what that means. My guest today is Michael Simanga. So Michael, one of the things that you mentioned was how the Nazis studied Jim Crow, but that was also the thing for the architects of apartheid. They too study that. So one of the things I often do, in addition to studying the whole Reconstruction period, is looking at Nazi, documentaries, because part of my intrigue is how did this sociopath get a nation of people to turn against other folks, including neighbors, sometimes relatives, and do it in a masterful way. And to me, that it's frightening, but it's also intriguing. And I just saw a documentary the other night about Hungary's, you know, struggle with Nazism, because Hungary, this I didn't know none of this, was the last country that was invaded by Germany. And so they had the stories of these five survivors. And one of the things that one of the women did that struck me, she said, people would say, well, why come y'all didn't do anything? You know, y'all didn't resist. And she said it happened so slowly. First it was they changed the laws and just kind of what you were talking about, changed the laws that affected Jewish people. And their response was, well, that's not going to affect me. I'm Hungarian. They considered themselves Hungarian, and Jewishness was their religion. So they saw themselves as totally acclimated, integrated into the society, neighbors, loving neighbors, are we all Hungarians, yada, yada, yada. And she said when it finally came down and they saw neighbors aligning with the Nazis that they had lived with for years, they were just taken aback. So my point is, we have historical markers, evidence of what happens when these sort of authoritarian Nazi kind of, you know, movements, what they mean. And the 6 million Jews were killed with the world watching, including the U.S. Let's not get this twisted. Folks knew what was happening in Germany, even though we didn't have social media. They knew what was happening in Rwanda. You know, yep. Y'all's black, so-called black president, Bill Clinton, refused to acknowledge that it was genocide, because if he did, he'd have, that would trigger certain kinds of, responses from the federal government. So we watched a million Africans, you know, die, and folks barely did anything. So again, we have the historical body of evidence that tells us where this is going. I want to move us to things that are happening now that are part of this historical, piece of us fighting for self-determination, fighting for basic rights. So last week I had, Alicia Hernandez, from, Jobs for Justice, and Francesco Menses from the Black Collective in Miami, talking about this, the campaign that the GOP has to criminalize protest. And so in Florida, you know, DeSantis signed HB1, which, you know, definitely criminalizes a protest. And we've been fighting, beating it back here for the last several years. So we've been successful up to a point. But the legislative session is not over. But over the last 5 years, nearly 300 of these kinds of bills have been introduced in almost every state in the union. Yep. And I'm saying that people need to be mindful of what state you're in, and if such a law is already been enacted, or if they're trying to push it. Because here's the thing for me, Michael, you throwing all this stuff at me, at us, and then you say we can't even protest, we can't even like fight back, right. We can't even have a picket sign that says I don't agree with you oppressing me because I'm a black female. What? Mm-hmm. No.
Right. And it's a fundamental right in the Constitution.
Exactly. But it goes back to us talking about whatever's there really doesn't apply to us. But the other thing is, you know, and this is in your hometown where Cop City is being protested, and you know, here's an 85-acre, 90 million police training facility trying to come up at a time when our people are moving. It said, we're moving away from mass incarceration. We're moving away from policing in the way that you all have envisioned it for the last 50 years. We don't want that. We think we got something better. And even on the road to abolition, we're going to try to reform it and make it as humane as it can. But we're not going to be using tax dollars for some 85-acre facility on top of Native American land. What is wrong with you all? But here's what y'all did. Y'all charged these people with domestic terrorism. And when I told folks that at the National State of the Black World Convention last week in Baltimore, folks didn't even know that. So they have upped the ante on us. It's not just y'all, you know, y'all might be arrested and we'll charge you bond and you got to show up. We want to charge you with domestic terrorism. How is that going to work for you? We're going to keep your butt in jail till you get ready to go to trial. You're going to have to put out some money for your legal defense. We've already seen, the sister from Black Collective said that they've already seen the chill on the kind of mobilization for protest in Miami based on HB1 passing. So what is going on here?
Well, see, this is a perfect description of what is happening. The consolidation of the right wing led by the most extreme folks in the right wing. You know, it's the right wing, the Republican Party, they're like everything else. They're not homogeneous. You know, there's some people who are more extreme than others. There's some who hate black people and all people of color. There's some, I would say more than some, who hate women. There's some who hate, you know, LGBTQ folks. But they will concede that those who don't hate like that for the benefit that they get from it. So this is one of the dilemmas that we have, that we are not organized in the same way, and with very little, if any, help from the Democratic Party. They've been silent on almost every one of these issues that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's on a local, national, or state level, that we don't get the pushback from them that we're getting in terms of the aggression of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is because in many ways there are people who agree with that.
Exactly.
In Democratic Party. So when we talk about democracy and we elect people to go and, you know, make laws and pass stuff to make sure that we live in a democratic society, and then you have people who just will remain silent. It's like the silence of Nazism, you know, mm-hmm. that thing you just said about Hungary. Oh, mm-hmm. It's not going to be me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm American. Yeah. That's somebody else.
Right. It ain't going to happen to me. And almost every black person shot by the police in the last few years is an American.
Mm.
You know.
Shot by an American.
Huh?
Shot by an American.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But I think that the movements that have arisen and the, you know, there's a large contingency of veteran organizers and stuff, many of whom cannot march like they used to, but they can tell you what's in their head, mm-hmm. you know, that might be helpful. More than anything else at this moment, I think, in American history, there's got to be a broad united front of people. And it has to cross racial, nationality, gender identity. It has to be, people have to say, either we work together or we lose everything, every fight. Because we don't have the strength. Let's look at Jackson, Mississippi, where literally the white state government is taking over a black city.
Mm.
I think about Flint, Michigan. You know, that was the result of white supremacists and the Republican Party getting hold of the governorship and both chambers of the state legislature, and could basically do what they wanted to do. They disbanded democracy in Detroit and appointed a emergency manager so that they could, you know, rob the city and control the biggest city in Michigan. This poisoning of a majority black city in Flint. And even after doing it, they talked about it callously, like it wasn't no big deal. That's just some poor black people, poor white people there. So what?
Yeah, yeah. And we can go right here in St. Louis. We are literally fighting for our elected prosecutor who's been on in the crosshairs for at least ever since she got in office. But these are reform elected officials that we not only elected her once, but twice by a hefty margin. But yet the state attorney general says she's not doing her job and she's on this whole thing of trying to defend herself. She's got a trial coming up, Michael, to defend why she should continue being the prosecuting attorney. And don't let me start with the Nashville people who they decided you all want to protest in the chambers. Y'all out of here. So, I mean, just summarily, they're just striking down folks who we elected as if that doesn't mean a damn thing.
And that's how we know how dangerous it is right now. This is different than it was even 4 or 5 years ago. That there is an open aggression of white supremacy and male supremacy and Nazism. I mean, we got people walking around openly declaring themselves as Nazis.
Right.
And the Ku Klux Klan and these other right-wing organizations are wide open, out in the open. They're not hiding anymore. They're openly talking about killing, you know, black and brown people. They're openly talking about the driving women back into a submissive state as God directed them.
And eliminating gay folks, you know.
Oh, yeah, they got to go.
Right.
And so when you look at where we are, this is why I'm saying that people should continue doing their work. It's resistance has to happen whether we have the strength to accomplish everything we want or not. But there has to be resistance to oppression. Frederick Douglass, you know, no progress without struggle. That we have to fight where we can right now, but we have to be thinking about how do we connect these fights and what is our strategy. This is moving so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And next year is a presidential election. And if the Democrats win, and this is important for us strategically to think about stuff, because what you were saying earlier, people say, well, nothing's going to change. It doesn't matter. Yeah, it does matter. In any conflict, you have to have allies, and those allies are both long-term, short-term, some of them last a day. But you have to have allies to fight for what you want, and you have to be able to, you know, negotiate those relationships, because it advances our struggle. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people, I think some of these people are hired to do this. You know, I see on social media where they are super critical of everything, and people say, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter if you do that, or that person's not revolutionary enough, or this person doesn't understand politics, whatever. The basic thing is that we have to see only a broad coalition can stand up to this. Because we're getting beat in every state.
We're getting beat in every state on every level. And, here's the thing that we have to also remember, Michael, is that, you know, our government has always been a collaborator with these right wingers, whether it be with the Klan or, you know, the Jim Crow laws and all the way down. And even now, you know, Biden's, Department of Justice is one of the ones calling for, you know, so-called protesters to be, you know, dubbed as domestic terrorism. So when people think about whenever the government says there's a war on, then people always say, well, good, that, you know, now we're going to get rid of that. That's a war on black and brown communities, like war on drugs. We know what that's about. Now this war on terrorism is really about the folks pushing back against these repressive laws. And so you're right. If we don't have a broad coalition of the willing and the able, you know, these folks are organized. They got a 10, 20, 30, 50 year plan that they are unfolding before our eyes. You know, people used to say, you put it in the book, you know, people ain't gonna read it. They're not even putting it on the book. They telling you, we get ready to do this, and this is what's gonna happen to you. You want to be out there protesting? You now a domestic terrorism. So when we thought about this whole thing, even under the Patriot Act, we thought it was because of the 9/11 attack. All of that has been used against citizens of the U.S.
That's right.
And so let's not get this twisted. When we talk about domestic terrorism, we want to think, oh, okay, they're going to go after the Klan. They're going to go after the Boogie Boy. No. They're not. I'm going to tell you, I really was trying to restrain myself from being an alarmist when talking about this stuff, but what made a believer out of me was January the 6th, when I saw those folks scaling the Capitol, breaching security with very little resistance from those inside. I said, wow, we've moved to a whole nother level, so I have to be the one telling my people, this is it, y'all. We got to do something different. We got to do it smarter. And we got to do it big, because these folks are coming after us.
And we have to put aside some of our differences,
which are pale in comparison with what we're getting ready to face.
Right. That's exactly right. And this means, too, that we have to encourage people who are in churches, mosques, temples, community organizations. One of the things that we learned in the previous era of resistance is political education is not just for the organizers. It has to be done on a community level, institution by institution, church by church, which means we also have to be able to frame stuff in a way that is teachable, because what we know is from years of study and experience. And so in like Cop City, for instance, there are way more active folks around it who are not from the black community. And that's not a bad thing, except that means that the people in the black communities around Atlanta are either unaware or don't care. And not don't care emotionally. They don't care because it's just one more thing. Are we going to fight this too? Maybe, you know, we just need to let that go and deal with something else. So that's the second thing. You know, we have to think about how do we pull people together who are fighting these different issues. You might have great ideological differences, but can we agree that we need more people who are protesting and trying to prevent Cop City. Can we register more people to vote? This is, the voting is actually on the local level where it's more powerful. Because you wind up electing people who are like the, there in St. Louis, you know, the district attorney. We have to put those people in office because we got to have people in there to fight these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't just turn it over to them. And even if they are not successful on every issue, somebody has to stand up and say, no, we're not. It's like the people in Nashville. They were like, no, we're not doing this.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we're going to come right down to this, to the well and say what needs to be said, and it's going to be in the official record.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1,000 people outside are going to go get 5,000 more.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mm-hmm. so we have to have people who are elected to office, but they have to also be on our side.
Right.
It don't matter what color they are. They have to mm-hmm. be on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is that we have to be vigilant to not let whatever we build in terms of relationships with different community organizations, political organizations. The history is that the opposition, both the governmental opposition and the non-governmental opposition, will do everything they can to break that up because they know that's a more formidable, you know, opponent. And so we have to really be committed to this strategy of working with each other. There's no way that we can hold back this without that.
Right.
And that conversation has to be going on right now, and people on a local level have to say, yeah, let's meet once a month. All these different organizations, let's meet and see what we can do together. And in many ways, it has to be, it's not an ideological discussion. It is a practical discussion. What can we do together to build unity and to fight these people? I think about this all day, every day, that, like you, that January 6th thing just told me that this is a whole other level of what's getting ready to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That was a test run.
Right.
And everything is followed. After that, we have not been able to put any kind of halt to.
Mm.
They are on the march.
Right.
And we are, we're not ready for it. And I don't think there's any blame to it. I'm just saying that we have to recognize we're not ready for it.
And I think that's the place where we have to be at. We have to be doing a clarion call to our advanced folks who understand
right.
this. But the also, when you talk about education, and we know this even from, you know, liberation movements, you got to go inside these neighborhoods and let people know what it is. And I don't think we've done a really good job about doing that. We're talking to each other in social movements, but the folks who we need to be moving and need to be protecting and having them understand what's getting ready to happen are those folks, you know, in these, mm-hmm. these communities, and we seem to be bypassing that because that's the hard work. It is hard.
It is absolutely hard work. And, you know, with these repressive moves being made to eliminate black studies and black literature and those kind of things, we knew what to do with that. Those programs didn't even exist when we began our work in this movement. And so we opened schools. Saturday schools, after school schools, summer schools,
mm-hmm.
and we taught, you know, the reading, writing, and arithmetic and science and stuff, but we also taught the black stuff,
mm-hmm.
the history, the literature, the politics, so that those students who came through those programs, they went into the world knowing, okay, yeah, I understand. I understand what the program is. I understand, you know, what we should be aspiring to. I understand how to organize in the community. We have to go back to a lot of that stuff and modernize it. And it should be, in some ways, easier because the technology is so much better. But we have to use it for those purposes. This is, I think, the most important issue. Of all of the issues is, can progressive forces unite?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a mystical unity. It's not a religious unity. You know what I mean? Right. It's not an ideological unity. It is a unity to fight against fascism.
I mean, really, it's about building an anti-fascist movement like they did
exactly
in Europe.
I
mean, this is real to us. And here's the thing. Even in terms of mass incarceration, I remember, and I have to tell people, black folks, we got to be responsible in our quest for self-determination. So when they started coming after our folks because we said, this crack cocaine is killing our communities, get these folks out of here. Well, they did.
Yep.
To the tune of 2 million people. So
right.
let's see if there's some other ways that we can deal with bringing our community to task when there's some harm that's been done, some restorative justice. And let's not be calling our oppressors and our enemies when we got to resolve an issue. So that, to me, is also part of the education that we think, let them do it. We just tell them what they, okay, yeah, how does that work for us? You know?
Right, as those chains are being put on your legs. Right?
Yeah, and to think about the number of men and women who got caught up in that net that we said, cast your net wide, get them all out of here. And now we're coming up with all these men and women who were wrongfully convicted because people were trying to build careers off of our backs in these prosecutors' office. And so,
oh, yeah.
So we got a lot to do.
Multiply that by the impact on their families.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, you have somebody who swept up in that and they were the main breadwinner. That has a profound effect upon a family. Or they were one of two breadwinners, but they were still, you know, right at the line of being able to survive. So it's all of that.
Right.
But I think that for us, you're right, an anti-fascist front and movement that is heavily on educating, you know, this stuff is coming. This violence is coming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's here, but it ain't here like it was. Remember during the last presidential election where people tried to run in Texas a Biden bus off the road,
mm-hmm.
a campaign bus?
Uh-huh.
They reported that on the news like somebody had fell off their bike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, literally people with guns trying to run a campaign bus, and nothing happened to them. Nobody was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody was prosecuted. And if you just look at the day-to-day things that have happened, okay, Fox News, which we knew, was exposed as a right-wing propaganda machine that was openly telling lies under the disguise of news. We knew that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, but what does it mean when 30, 40 million people watch that all day?
Mm-hmm. Every day.
Yes. What does it mean that the most powerful force in Christianity right now is white racist evangelicals, which they are spreading across the world, and particularly in developing countries, in Africa and other places? What does that mean that the church is in the White House and the church's husband is on the Supreme Court?
Hmm. Well.
You know, We can't ignore that.
No, no, no.
But we can't do anything about it without that kind of unity that we're talking about.
And the thing that I have about being, you know, a so-called alarmist is that I don't want people to get so overwhelmed by what we're talking about that they feel like can't do anything. Because
right.
what I always say, just pick one issue. One thing.
Yeah.
We can't solve it all together. But pick one thing that you are particularly passionate about. Find some other folks who are equally passionate about it and start moving. But this broader banner of this anti-fascist movement, we have to be in concert or else we are going to get buried. I mean, this just, I don't see any other way around it. When we'll look up and we'll be under some laws that we thought were meant for other people, and here we are having the two. I mean, we could talk about the Japanese internment. We could talk about all of this stuff that happened to people who thought they were Americans, that they were making, contributing as, you know, they were told to, and look what happened to them. So again, we got plenty of, you know, examples throughout our history that, you know, when it comes to saving the status quo, that it's by any means necessary.
Absolutely. And right now, the objective has to be to not go backward. I mean, we're in a defensive position right now, so we have to strengthen our defenses while planning for whatever comes next. And people can continue doing the work that they're doing. They should, you know, on a local basis and on a national basis. But we have to have some national unity of, you know, folks who are against this stuff. It's the only way.
And those who are against it have to be more vocal, so that people understand that it's a serious time, and that, you know, it's going to be uglier if we do little or nothing. You can count on that. It's going to get uglier for us as a people, particularly, and for anybody who's trying to organize against the injustices. Is going to be difficult for them. And so at least if you're not going to do anything, do something to make sure that the people who are still doing the work and the organizing, that they can continue to do it. Because otherwise, when we are, our voices are muffled, or we are in jail or prison for being a domestic terrorist, how is that going to work for our community? So I think, go ahead.
I was gonna say, and that what you just said is powerful and beautiful, because in our own experience, we know people do what they can do. I remember in one of the uprisings in Detroit around police issues, and this brother and I were at a meeting, and people called and said the police out here wilding on us. So you remember that picture was on the front of Unity and Struggle that had a police car on fire?
Right, right.
It was that night. So we get there, we talk with some young people trying to see what's going on and stuff, and the police just start shooting tear gas at us. So we all running down the street. And this elderly sister, she looked like she was 90 years old, came out on the porch and said, "Y'all come in here." And we ran in there, and she gave us towels and stuff to put on our eyes, and she kept looking out the door, and she said, "The police are gone, y'all can go back out now." And I thought, that might have been the only thing she ever did. But it probably saved our lives. And she took a stance. She was like, "No, you come in here and let them go by." And there's stories like that over and over again. So we have to let people be who they are and accept what they can give, and not look at that as, "Well, you're not revolutionary enough, you're not political enough." We have to let people give what they can give, and let us give what we can give. But you are so right. We have to begin this process right now.
Right. Michael, it has been a pleasure talking about this, even though it's a very difficult and challenging conversation, and it's one that's got to continue. I mean, we out of time right now, but it's got to continue for anybody who heard the conversation. Yes, there's a lot to talk about, but there's much more organizing that needs to be done. So, Michael, thanks again for being a part of the conversation and helping lay out what our task is going forward. And I do want to remind people that this is Black History Month, and there's always lots to do and see. I have a few things for you, so get your pen and paper out. Tonight, there is going to be a webinar that's part of the Black and Green monthly forum, and that is at 7:30. In order to get information about the Black and Green Forum, you need to call 314-721-8554. And they're going to be talking tonight about degrowth and how food is grown locally, and you don't want to miss that. Tomorrow morning, the descendants of St. Louis University Enslaved is going to be doing a webinar. No, it's not even a webinar. It's going to be in person at Bush Auditorium. So that's going to be on SLU's campus. But these are the folks who are descendants of slaves that helped to build SLU and other Catholic institutions. So that ought to be real interesting. That's going to be at 10 a.m. So that's in the morning at SLU. You probably can go to the website and get more information. Now, tomorrow night is going to be an important community meeting as well. The Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression will be talking about the Civilian Oversight Board and how you can join. Megan Green, who is president of the Board of Alders, will be there to help us understand that process better. So that's at 6 p.m. at the Deaconess Center,
1000 North Vandeventer. It's free and open to the public, so you don't want to miss that. Again, that's tomorrow night, February 8th, and that is the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, really moving the whole process of civilian oversight forward. So last but not least, next week we will be talking about black love. And I'm sure it will be in a way that you've never heard it discussed before. So please join us. If you missed any of the shows, or if you want to listen to them again, please go to my updated website and pull that off. Just want to give a shout out to Miles, my webmaster, who's done a fabulous job at redesigning the website to make it easier for you to access the radio shows and my articles. So thanks again. And thank you for listening. This is Jamala Rogers, and I'll see you on the battlefield.
No procrastination.
Right now, we've got to do the right thing.
We've got to do it right.